later on. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
Thank you.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro's popularity has hit the lowest point of his time in office ahead of a presidential election next year. Venezuela and Bolivia reject US claims that they have failed to meet their counter-narcotics obligations. And Africa is facing a 470 million shortfall in COVID vaccine doses this year after the COVAX Alliance cut its projected shipments. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro's popularity has fallen to its lowest point ahead of elections next year. That's according to a poll conducted in Brazil. The poll was carried out between September 13 and 15. It shows that 53% of Brazilians disapproved of Bolsonaro. That's up from 51% set in a last survey in July. President Bolsonaro has come under heavy condemnation over a series of issues, including unemployment and rising inflation. He's also under fire over the handling of Brazil's COVID outbreak, one of the deadliest in the world. Bolsonaro's popularity is sinking ahead of a presidential election due for October next year. Polls show him trailing behind his likely opponent, former President Lula da Silva. In Argentina, people have poured into the streets of the capital, Buenos Aires, to protest against poverty and soaring unemployment. Protesters are also asking for more social programs, public work, and assistance at soup kitchens. The march was called by a group of social organizations affiliated to the left-wing Workers' Party. Argentina is struggling to leave behind a years-long recession marked by high inflation. The crisis has been deepened by lockdown measures introduced to contain the coronavirus pandemic. Over 40% of Argentina's population lives in poverty, with an unemployment rate exceeding 10%. staying in the region of Venezuela and Bolivia have rejected U.S. claims that they have failed to meet their counter-narcotics obligations. Caracas accused Washington of behaving like a supranational police of sovereign and independent states. Venezuela said it complies strictly with the requirements of international conventions on controlling narcotics. Bolivia defended its counter-narcotics efforts too. It said Washington's report on those efforts is unilateral. The U.S. has released a memo claiming that the two South American countries had failed to improve their counter-narcotics efforts over the last 12 months. U.S. officials have long accused the top Venezuelan officials of being involved in drug trafficking, a charge denied by Caracas. Camila Escalante in Bolivia explains why the country has rejected the U.S. report on its fight against drugs.
Bolivian officials, the Minister of Government or the Minister of Interior, Eduardo Castillo, he reacted quickly saying that, like you said, this is a unilateral report and doesn't follow the same sort of protocol as the other, what he classifies as legitimate bodies and organizations that work with the Bolivian state here on the ground in order to monitor the eradication of coca, illicit coca crops. So he said that unlike the EU and the United Nations, the US has absolutely no presence here in Bolivia. But beyond that, this is, of course, a report that was written about the coup regime period, which was for the most part the year 2020. And so, of course, those numbers, a United Nations report came out recently, which show us that, in fact, coca eradication, illicit coca eradication, plummeted during the 12-month coup.
A new opinion poll suggests U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating has dropped to its lowest since he took office in January. The latest Reuters Ipsos poll showed 50% of Americans disapprove of Biden's performance, compared to 43% who said they approved of him. The president's popularity has been on the decline since mid-August when the U.S.-backed government in Afghanistan collapsed. A recent surge in the number of COVID-19 cases and fatalities in the country has also contributed to the fall in Biden's rating. Some 46% of the respondents said they disapproved of the president's COVID-19 response. Just over 1,000 Americans participated in the national poll. The error margin is reported to be 4 percentage points. Our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, tells us more about how Americans feel about President Joe Biden.
He's definitely facing a little bit of difficulty here. I mean, it's not a death knell for the current president. It does indicate that he is having some problems connecting with the American public, with his decision-making. It does mean that he should probably be a little bit more deliberative when making some very key policy decisions. We're looking at the pullout from Afghanistan being one of the major indicators as to why people disapprove of him as president. Of course, the Delta variant and the COVID-19 response probably factoring into that somewhat as well. The other third part of this is, what exactly has the president accomplished so far? We've talked about voting rights legislation. That hasn't gone through. We've talked about increased pay and trying to level, bring up pay scales for people. That really hasn't happened. So now there are many people wondering just how effective is the president? If he campaigned as a candidate on a president who would be able to walk across the aisle, make deals with his political rivals, with his political adversaries, but he's not doing that, that makes him look weak and ineffective, and that is going to reflect adversely in his approval numbers.
Elsewhere, the World Health Organization says Africa faces a 470 million shortfall in COVID vaccine doses this year because of cuts in shipments. Vaccines expected to reach Africa by the end of the year would be enough to vaccinate only 17% of the population there. That's according to the WHO's Africa unit. It says that figure is far below the 40% global target of inoculation. According to the organization, the International COVAX initiative has been forced to cut Africa's deliveries because of global vaccine shortages. The WHO says the shortages are partly due to export bans put by rich countries. It has warned that the lag in shipments to Africa could result in emergence of vaccine-resistant variants that could send the world back to square one. The European Commission announces plans to establish an emergency response agency after failing to deal with COVID-19. Critics, including many EU lawmakers, say the €6 billion price tag for the new authority cannot be justified. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions. But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margaritis Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost €1 billion per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis. Activists claim the €6 billion would be better spent taking in desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russians in the Far East are casting their ballots as polls open for three-day parliamentary elections. 450 seats are up for grabs. At the lower house of parliament, voters will pick from one of 14 parties to send lawmakers to parliament. The governing United Russia Party currently has a supermajority with 334 seats. President Vladimir Putin needs the party to win big once again to boost his chances for re-election in 2024. Political commentator George Sazimueli says the United Russia ruling party will do pretty well in the parliamentary elections.
Probably Putin's party, United Russia, will do well, not as well as last time, but I think that they will do pretty well. What I think is interesting is that the alternative to United Russia will not be any of the so-called liberal parties very much favored by the West. I mean, it's the alternative will be the communists and the Liberal Democrats, the so-called Liberal Democrats, which is the party of Vladimir Zhirinovsky. I think they're going to do well, but the kind of the alternative, like the Yabloko, the various civic parties, I think that they're going to be wiped out. I don't think they're going to do well at all.
The lineup of Afghanistan's new caretaker government announced recently continues to spark mixed reactions in the Afghan society. While many welcome the formation of the new government, many others believe that such a government will not last a long time because it is not an inclusive one. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
The postponement of declaration of an inclusive government by the Taliban has faced mixed reactions here in Afghanistan. Many Afghans praise the Taliban for bringing calm and security for locals, but in the meantime, they are concerned about the fate of their lives due to political instability and widespread poverty and joblessness.
Security has been restored since the Islamic Emirate has taken power in Afghanistan, but we are facing serious challenges, especially when it comes to social and political issues. Most government bodies and banks are not functioning and factories remain closed.
This comes as the Taliban say, "We are committed to form an inclusive government in order to bring a lasting political stability and peace to this war-ravaged country and want locals to be patient." The Taliban have already left out women from the cabinet lineup. This has led many to voice their concerns regarding the rights of women under the new government in Afghanistan.
Taliban need to win the hearts and minds of people, especially women, because leaving out the women from the government will spark international community refusal to support the new government. So they must take our demand seriously.
I ask the Taliban to try to win the hearts and minds of women instead of threatening us or depriving us of our basic rights. They must act based on true Islamic law. In this case, we will also support them.
A Taliban spokesman, Sohail Shaheen, announced recently that Taliban will protect women's rights within the religious law. Despite this, some major cities of Afghanistan, including capital Kabul, have so far witnessed demonstrations by women rights activists as a reaction to Taliban's no to the presence of women in high-ranking government positions.
The international community is under growing pressures from the global public opinion to urge Taliban to establish an inclusive government by including women and respecting their rights in the society. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Italian capital, Rome, is hosting a Palestinian cultural event dubbed the Philistine Festival. Discussions on the plight of the Palestinians are on the agenda. Max Civilli has more in this report.
The second Philistine Festival opened its doors in Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo quarter on Thursday. The four-day initiative has been organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio region, and it is supported by a number of Italian organizations, including the National Association of Italian Partisans, ANPI. The festival aims to build intercultural understanding and promote Palestinian culture in the Italian capital.
Today we are doing this festival in the memory of Sabra Ishatella, and this is very important to tell the people that our suffering, it was from before and till now we are suffering more and more.
The festival features Palestine's traditional music and food and showcases films and books on the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Some attendees commented on Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's recent statements on Palestine, who reiterated his opposition to the establishment of a sovereign Palestinian state in the occupied territories after a meeting with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi earlier this week.
Israel must realize that the world is changing its mind over the occupied territories. Look at recent surveys in the U.S. Now Europeans also have to change their mind. It is the only solution. We must have our own state and all prisoners must be released.
My duty, for example, as European, to analyze and to criticize what European Union is doing. We are allowing Israel to be not accountable. The problem is to end the colonization and to end the Judaization of East Jerusalem.
The European Parliament's Budget Committee will meet at the end of this month to vote on 2022 contributions to the Palestinian Authority. Many are concerned about a possible cutback.
The Philistine Festival will continue until Sunday. It will be featuring round tables on crucial issues such as the international recognition of Palestine as a state, the ongoing attempts to Zionize Jerusalem al-Quds, and Italy's foreign policy towards the struggle of the oppressed Palestinians. Max Civilli, Rome.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
IB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
in the limelight.
The recent meeting in Moscow between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his Russian host, Vladimir Putin, was a shock to the terrorists. Whether those operating as mercenaries in the Levant or those directing them from the U.S., the oil-rich Arab states, occupied Palestine and certain West European capitals. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading Assad-Putin Summit Sounds Death Knell for Terrorists. Stay tuned for more. The recent meeting in Moscow between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his Russian host, Vladimir Putin, was a shock to the terrorists. Whether those operating as mercenaries in the Levant or those directing them from the United States, the oil-rich Arab states, occupied Palestine and certain West European capitals. It was a warm meeting between two friendly heads of sovereign independent states, who reviewed their vital cooperation and, of course, planned for future action for reconstruction of Syria and for liberation of the last remaining parts of that country under occupation from uninvited armies of the U.S. and Turkey. Russia recently arranged for the return to complete control of the Damascus government of Dara on the borders of Jordan, where sedition was first sparked in 2011. And devilishly exploited by the West and reactionary Arabs to plunge Syria into a 10-year crisis. Now, with the terrorists and their dependents transported to the occupied parts of Idlib in the northwest for the final push out from Syria, the local population that was displaced all these years is streaming back to their hometown. And with newfound confidence that no mischief mongers would ever be allowed in the future to disturb the peace of their hometowns, Jordan has been served notice that under any pretext, it would not be allowed to manipulate the suspicious elements lingering in its so-called refugee camps for causing cross-border tension, and this means the Americans and the Persian Gulf Arabs should also be careful about any misstep. Putin, in his long meeting with Assad that was later joined by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad and Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, felicitated his guest on winning the recent presidential elections, said, "Foreign armed forces that remain in certain regions of your country without the approval of the United Nations and without your permission have no right to stay." It means the presence of the American troops on Syrian soil is illegal and undesirable and should immediately end for the sake of peace and stability. It also meant that the U.S. sanctions on sovereign independent Syria are nothing but a form of economic and political terrorism against the charter of the world body. It should be noted that over the past decade, as many as 500,000 Syrians have been slaughtered by the macabrely murderous terrorists who have destroyed towns and cities and displaced 5 million people from their homes and hearth, in addition to driving out a number of people to eke a miserable life in neighboring Turkey or end up as unwanted and mistreated refugees in parts of Europe. President Bashar al-Assad, as he said in his inaugural re-election speech last month, is greatly indebted to the Islamic Republic of Iran for its timely help in defeating the terrorists and facilitating the arrival on request of the heroic forces of Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorism movement, the Hezbollah. It was Iran which also worked out cooperation between Damascus and Moscow for invitation of Russian troops in 2006 in order to offset the illegal presence of the U.S. forces. It should be recalled that President Assad had visited Tehran on a landmark visit on February 25, 2019, and met with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, thanks to the efforts of that great diplomat and field commander against terrorism, Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. criminally martyred in January 2020 in Baghdad.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
You are alone, in hiding, and more than 50,000 occupation soldiers and 6 million colonial settlers are looking for you. Drones, cameras, dogs, sensing and tracking technologies in a very narrow geographical space, all looking for you. Still, you succeed in disguising after you had succeeded in snatching your own freedom from underground days earlier. This is not only an achievement, but rather a victory over an entity that used all its assets day and night to bring back part of the stature it lost due to your bravery. There's no room for sadness for your capture. There's only room for pride and great dignity. Heart-wrenching news came out from Nazareth on Friday night. Palestinian heroes Mahmoud al-Qardah and Yaqub Qadri were seized by Israeli occupation forces 6 days after they liberated themselves and exposed the weakness and fragility of Israeli technological superiority and military hegemony at the high-security Gilboa prison. Hours later, heroes Zakaria Zubaydi and Mahmoud al-Arida were identified and seized in North Palestine, leaving two more comrades free to the time of this report. Estimates of the Israeli security services indicate that the two heroes, Munadil Nafat, 26-year-old, and Ayham Kamamji, 35, have separated from each other, and that at least one of them is in the occupied West Bank. It would be impossible for Palestinians and their comrades all across the world not to revel in six detainees carrying out a daring escape from one of Israel's most secure and modern jails. Israel may have worked over time to demonize the six men as terrorists, but for us, they are among Palestine's finest and bravest foot soldiers. People received the news of the recapture of four out of the six heroes with a tear that preceded any other emotion and any words that were said. All Palestinians can identify with the plight of these men. Imprisonment is a rite of passage for much of the male Palestinian population. Estimates are that many hundreds of thousands have passed through Israelis' jails over the past five decades. Many are in jail awaiting trial, as were two of the six escapees. Others are in administrative detention, jailed without trial or even being told what charges are leveled against them. Detainees' rights are seriously abused. They are kept in overcrowded cells, have little contact with their families, and are often beaten or tortured. Every Palestinian will glory in Israel's humiliation, and every pro-Palestinian as well. Guards failed to spot the prisoners gradually widening a hole in the drainage system in their cell over many months. The six men moved undetected past a sleeping guard, and they planned a sophisticated getaway that foiled a police manhunt hot on their tail. But the celebrations in Palestinian communities across the region and far beyond relate not just to the jailbreak. Every day the prisoners remain free is another hammer blow against the occupation. That is not just the way Palestinians see it. It is how Israel's officials and much of the public understand it too. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The heroic escape of six Palestinian detainees from an Israeli maximum security jail in the north of the occupied territories came as a strong slap in the face of the Tel Aviv occupying regime. The cellmates serving life sentences are believed to have fled through an underground tunnel from the Israeli detention center, which they had managed to dig over the past few months. This great act of liberation from the maximum security Gilboa prison confused Israelis, leading its regime and troops to launch a wide manhunt to rearrest the Palestinian heroes. The whole world stood in awe at this great escape, as this operation was a one-of-a-kind achievement only possible because of Palestinian will and perseverance, despite the recapture of four out of six of these heroes. To discuss this very important issue with us from the occupied Syrian Golan is liberated Syrian detainee Sidqi Al-Maqt, who spent 32 years, where the sum of the years that he spent in the, and then he was liberated from the prisons of the Israeli entity. Israelis released the hero according to his own conditions to return to Majd al-Shams rather than to be exiled to Damascus. It's an honor to have you with us, Mr. Sidqi Al-Maqt. Now, the great act of liberation happened when six brave men lowered themselves through the floor of their communal shower cubicle into a pre-existing subterrain, which is a cavity that extended beneath the prison and towards its perimeter, allowing them to evade 40 prison guards, three watchtowers, two walls, two barbed wire fences, and a pack of sniffer dogs. How on earth did they succeed?
These six prisoners were able to bypass all these fortifications. It is worth noting that Gilboa prison was built in 2004, where Israel put all its past experiences of managing prisons inside Gilboa. They even hired experts from Western colonial powers, especially from the UK, benefiting from the British prisons in Ireland. Israel fortified the jail in terms of construction, fortification, procedures, and control. Despite all this, these six heroes were able to escape. I personally know three of the six heroes, while I myself was a detainee in Gilboa. They were able to bypass the daily security inspections and all the security cameras and the security personnel. They benefited from the cavity which was under their communal shower cubicle and then dug a long tunnel that extended for 25 meters. It is a miraculous operation, a nearly impossible operation, yet the heroes were able to bypass all these obstacles and were able to snatch their freedom with their bare hands. I extend my regards to these heroes.
Well, Mr. Sidqi, the six men were among about 7,000 Palestinians incarcerated in Israeli prisons after being either convicted or accused of military activity, meaning they simply were just practicing their full right of resistance against an actual occupation on their land. This great escape resurfaced the plight of the Palestinian detainees being illegally kept in Israeli detention centers. And now, after this escape, Israel is cracking down on all other Palestinian prisoners. How do you think will these Israeli provocations be received by the Palestinians in the occupied territories and elsewhere inside of Palestine? And what pressure do you think that the West Bank can actually exert to stop these provocations?
In the aftermath of each escape attempt, whether it succeeds or fails, and throughout the past decades, for prisoners have made scores of attempts, some have succeeded, others failed. Following each attempt, the prison management took revenge against the prisoners, first to vent their grudge and wrath against the prisoners. Due to their failure to foil the escape attempts, they vented their grudge and anger for having fallen into a fiasco. Now, this escape, along with other previous attempts, have mounted to a major scandal. Now, other prisoners, whether in the detention center where the escape took place or in other centers, are facing oppression. There are scores of detention centers. There are more than 4,000 Palestinian and Arab prisoners, 4,000 freedom fighters. Today, a war is being waged against them, a declared war from the prison management to confiscate all the past achievements. While we were in the occupation prisons, we have accumulated a lot of experience over tens of years. Through open hunger strikes, several achievements have been made in order to achieve minimum dignified human life, only the minimum and nothing more. Now, the prison management is trying to take away all these achievements and to take the prisoners back to square one. This creates a stage of rage, wrath, and detention within the occupation prisons. Nowadays, the occupation prisons are more like a powder keg that can go off any moment. The prisoners now are planning to respond to this war through declaring an open hunger strike. They are expected to declare a strike soon, so that our people in Palestine and the others in our nation masses can support this strike. Now, this is an opportunity to plead to all the honorable free people of our Palestinian people and the Arab world and the free people of the world to stand by the side of our prisoners who are being subjected to the most hideous campaigns of crackdown and suppression inside the occupation prisons.
Well, Mr. Sidqi, many Palestinians celebrated this kind of a rare indignity of the Israeli security establishment, which directly governs more than 60% of the West Bank and has a lot of other control over the rest of the West Bank. And Gaza, while it sadly coordinates its security issues with the Palestinian Authority led by President Mahmoud Abbas. Now, after the recapture of the four heroes in the 1948 occupied territories, do you think that the Palestinian Authority actually dodged a tough one here, given that according to its coordination policy with the Zionist entity, it would have been obliged to coordinate the manhunt against all six of them had they actually entered the West Bank?
The Palestinian people can no longer stand this authority nor the security coordination with Israel and all the laws and measures that are imposed on the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people longs for freedom, and this authority is the product of the Oslo Accords, which are now over, along with all their consequences. The Israeli occupation does not recognize any agreements or conventions, and the PA has reached a dead end. If these hero detainees had reached the PA territories, they would have caused a great embarrassment to the PA, because on the one hand, the PA cannot protect them, and on the other, cannot but detain them and hand them over to the occupier. This would have been a major quagmire. These prisoners moved to the Palestinian territories occupied in 1948, and there, four of them were arrested. The Palestinian people is currently boiling due to the consequences of this heroic operation. This operation has been a slap in the face of the occupier and proved how much this occupier is disintegrated and how much its apparatuses are irrelevant and inefficient due to this heroic operation. And when four of them were arrested, we felt a state of boiling, a severe state of boiling, that indicates a forthcoming intifada and future confrontation against the occupier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are certain human rights groups that describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to bring its use to an end. Might we actually be seeing another form of collaboration between the interior occupied Palestinian lands and the Gaza Strip to bring back the plight of these thousands of detainees out into the open again?
There are more than 4,000 Palestinian and Arab prisoners in Israeli detention centers. Some of them sentenced to life in prison. Some were sentenced to 10 lives in prison and 20 lives and 30 and 40 and 60 lives. Can you imagine? Sentenced to life 68 times. There are scores of detainees that amount to hundreds that have been detained for more than 30 years inside Israeli detention centers. There is a group of detainees that have spent 40 years behind bars. This is an opportunity for me to plead to our resistance fighters to work hard to liberate our detainees from occupation prisons. These international human rights organizations, which you mentioned, have never achieved anything. They are ineffective, and when we were detained, we never knew that these organizations ever existed, and we never received anything from them. These international organizations have never liberated one detainee. They have never helped one detainee out of solitary confinement. This is a big lie. We rely on the efforts of our Palestinian people and on the honorable resistance factions in our region to be able to liberate our detainees. The big question that remains now is, what will happen to the 4,000 detainees inside Israeli detention centers?
Mr. Sidqi Al-Maqad, liberated Syrian detainee from the occupied Syrian Golan, it was our honor to have you on with us to talk about the six heroes that took their liberty away from the Zionist occupation. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the new cabinet in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Will the new government of Najib Miqati be given public confidence? It is hard to say, given that this government seems to be representing the interests of the system that engineered the collapse of the country and manufactured this disastrous burden on the Lebanese society. It all came out crystal clear as the identities of the ministers were announced, the majority of whom will play a major role in the negotiations with the International Monetary Fund and the development of an awaited financial reform plan. Ministers clearly representing the interests of the central bank, international private banks, and financial institutions, and most notably the interests of the United States of America. A new Lebanese cabinet formed in this following report.
If last week's formation of the new government in Lebanon headed by Najib Miqati is a reflection of the continued power of the strong and its exploitation by the popular classes to strengthen its political and economic influence so that a very small group of beneficiaries can enjoy it, then it is certain that the ministerial formation expresses everything that contradicts the interest of the Lebanese to end the economic, financial, monetary collapse entering its second year. Between ministers who openly adopt the policies of the United States of America and reject economic cooperation with regional countries, adhere to the ideas of international financial institutions, and defend the interests of Lebanon's existing system of failure, people are terrified at how their future will be shaped by this new government's decisions. It is true that the destination was clear from the moment Miqati was assigned, one of the hardcore members of the system, but the issue took a blunt form with the announcement of the new ministers. The Lebanese people are wary of this government. Why? Well, because unless government headed by Najib Miqati takes a position on building a communal state that secures equal opportunities for all residents and provides them with basic services, then all hope has been lost. The essence of any solution for Lebanon is political, not technical, based on answering one question. Whose interests will the new cabinet defend?
the interests of the banking and financial sector and all the beneficiaries of it who want to throw the burden of private bank losses on the shoulder of the general population, or the interests of the poor and middle classes whose deposits were stolen, their salaries lost their values, their purchasing power collapsed, and they were denied access to petrol, diesel, medicine, hospitalization, and housing? The basic step in addressing the crisis is to acknowledge its occurrence and to identify the ensuing losses and how they are to be distributed. That is the development of a financial reform plan. The objective of the plan is to show the losses in the Lebanese Central Bank and private banks, restructuring the banks in a way that enables them to exercise their role in the economy and return to performing their normal function, the most important of which is activating lending, especially to the productive sectors. Restructuring the public debt so that its sustainability does not remain a burden on all future generations. Determining the economic vision of the state and on the basis of which a new exchange rate system must be adopted to end the jigsaw of the collection of different exchange rates. This means that the criminal audit of the accounts of the central bank and the private banks must be launched, and Central Bank Governor Riyad Salemi must be held responsible for abusing the one job he had to secure the Lebanese currency.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Professor Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and professor of history and international relations from the Lebanese University. Thank you, Dr. Jamal, for being with us. Now, 2 years after the start of the Lebanese economic and financial collapse and a year after the tragic August 4th explosion, a new government has been finally agreed upon in Lebanon. Yet the names of the ministers who are on board with Najib Mikati's cabinet are least to say provocative, and since many of them had actually a hand in engineering the collapse that we are living today. Now, also, they are audaciously and openly pro-American policies, and they don't even try to hide it. Is this a Lebanese cabinet or an IMF / U.S. Treasury one?
Well, too bad it's mainly a U.S., a French government imposed on Lebanon, but it's not the first time in our history. Actually, all governments throughout our history, since independence and even before independence, were all formed by foreign powers, mainly international, Western ones, with mild intervention by Eastern powers or regional powers. So the government he formed is also consists of similar elements on one hand, and also they reflect the, let's say, the balance and the shares of the United States first, France second, and with an attempt by the anti-Western parties in Lebanon to have like a veto vote inside the government. But this leads us to the conclusion that this government will only pass time until the next legislative elections, which are due in next spring.
Thinking, but Prime Minister Najib Mikati said the day that the cabinet was announced that he would seek to start negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. Hmm. Now, it seems that the ruling system in Lebanon thinks that they are smarter than the institutions of financial colonialism and that they can actually refuse its dictations, while at the same time they can obtain from it a loan between like 4 or 8 billion, which by the way would change nothing in Lebanon. Not even a 10 billion loan would actually change anything. But what would be the remaining and the lower classes in Lebanon would be feeling this heat? So what is the point of seeking an IMF if we are not actually going to abide by its demands?
Well, first, the IMF, we've been abiding by IMF instructions since 1992, by the way, and even before. So it was all IMF policies that led us to this disaster, by the way, including appointment of so-called experts and technocrats like Riyad Salemi and Fuad Sanyura, who were presented as technocrats before unveiling their true face and being representatives of neoliberal policies imposed on the country in order to prepare it for the deal of the century, which is to normalize relations with Israel, sacrifice Lebanese national interests, so on and so forth. The national debt was cut off because our national debt was estimated at around 100 billion, but most of it was in Lebanese pounds, up to 70 or 80%. So now with the devaluation of the currency, our debt was cut off by more than 80%. So now if they get like 8 to 10 or $10 billion in loans from the IMF, they will, of course, use it not to channel it to productive sector, but into their pockets through the banking sector, which dominates the country. Mm-hmm. But, and this will give a breathing space that they could rely on in order to get elected in the forthcoming elections. So this is how they don't have a national plan of for national recovery and for restructuring the economy to the benefit of the whole country. But they want to use this money just for their own sake, for their own interests, and that's why.
This is what I want to ask about the reform plan. A protective reform plan means re-examining the import policy, for example, in terms of what is allowed, what is prohibited, and maybe customs liabilities, whose goal should be to develop local production and increase the growth. Now, this measure, if accompanied by the passage of the general competition law in the country, would ensure the dismantling of the power of monopolies and cartels. But you are saying otherwise. And this would actually prevent their tyranny by ensuring the population's food, energy, health, and life security.
Definitely.
Now, the resistance, the Lebanese resistance has already begun with it, with the Iranian fuel. Will the government be able, or would the government want to actually go down that road?
Well, first, the government represents the interests of the dominant class, the rich, wealthy, rich and famous, okay? And they are bringing people from abroad with two nationalities, American citizenship and Lebanese citizenship, as if they are bringing football players to play in the
Champions
League.
Shouldn't that be illegal, though?
Huh?
Shouldn't that be illegal?
It should, but it's not in the case of Lebanon. Otherwise, all who would remain eligible to be elected to public office would be you and me, for example. Too bad. We don't have a law that imposes that the one who holds another nationality is forbidden from taking public office.
So in 30 seconds, you think that the government will not go down that road?
Definitely, because the government represents the interests of the financial class that is linked to international financial sectors and circles, and they don't want to go down the road to finance and subsidize a productive sector like industry and agriculture, but they want to boost imports through the way they did for the past 30 years. And this is why we, before talking about protecting the economy, we need to know what to protect. If we don't produce anything, so what would we be protecting? We need first to rebuild the productive sector and then see what we have to impose taxes on and what to allow into the country.
Thank you. Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and professor of history and international relations at the Lebanese University. Thank you for this very brief yet very important piece of knowledge about what to expect from this new cabinet in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The Limelight.
Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 went to for-profit defense contractors, a study released recently found. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Elaine Nick Mayer, writer. This article is published under the heading, Study Shows Pentagon Reliance on Contractors Hurt U.S. in 9/11 Wars. Stay tuned for more. Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 went to for-profit defense contractors, a study released recently found. While much of this money went to weapons suppliers, the research is the latest to point to the dependence on contractors for war zone duties as contributing to mission failures, in Afghanistan in particular. In the post-9/11 wars, U.S. corporations contracted by the Defense Department not only handled war zone logistics like running fuel convoys and staffing tow lines, but performed mission-crucial work like training and equipping Afghan security forces that collapsed last month as the Taliban swept the country. Within weeks and before the U.S. military had even completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban easily routed an Afghan government and military that Americans had spent 20 years and billions of dollars to stand up. President Biden placed blame squarely on the Afghan themselves. He said, "We gave them every chance. What we could not provide them was the will to fight."